Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we're speaking with Josh Breinlinger, who is the general partner and founder of Turtle Ventures, an early stage fund that invests in marketplace businesses. So Josh, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time and look forward to our conversation. You're in the process of starting a new fund, but it's not up and running yet. So I thought the best place to start maybe is with your background. So can you tell us a little bit about where you've been and how you became a VC investor?
Of course, and thanks for having me. So once upon a time, I was a mechanical engineer. I came from a very nerdy engineering family where I thought it was normal to have soldering irons and circuit boards at your dinner table. That's how I grew up.
Nice.
And so I did mechanical engineering for a few years, but all of that changed in 2004. I had a wonderful opportunity to become a member of the founding team at Odesk, which most of your listeners will probably know as Upwork now, which is a public company. And I joined the founding team, and that's the start of my marketplace journey. That's where I fell in love with marketplaces and started learning all about them. I was there for a little over 5 years as a business generalist type. And what that means is I was running sales, and then it was product and community, operations, customer service, marketing, and biz dev over the course of my time there. And it was just an absolutely wonderful experience. As I said, fell in love with marketplaces. I moved on in 2010, briefly went to a company called AdRoll in the display advertising space. I helped the founding team at Rev, which is in the speech to text space, another fantastic marketplace, and then moved into venture capital. And I was a general partner with Jackson Square Ventures for the past 5 years. Jackson Square Ventures is an early stage venture capital firm in San Francisco, mostly Series A, $440 million under management. But at the end of the day, I stepped down almost a year ago now. And as you said, I'm in the process of raising my own fund. I'm joining the ranks of solo capitalists. And the fund is called Turtle Ventures.
And what's the background behind that name, actually? Because at first it's like, wait, what? Turtle? Slow? Like, yeah. What were you thinking?
Yeah, I'm looking for really slow moving startups. So naming is always hard, right? Many of my friends told me it was the dumbest idea they've ever heard when they heard the name. I ignored them for better or worse. And the true story that I live on a small road called Turtle Creek Drive. And my previous firm was Jackson Square Ventures, which is in Jackson Square. And I was just doing lazy naming. So I was going to call it Turtle Creek Ventures. But it got me thinking about sea turtles. And when you think about it, they're one of the most amazing creatures on Earth. Sea turtles are, I think, one of the top three longest living creatures. There's been one recorded at 256 years old. And to me, that's one of the things that's always bothered me about venture capital is it feels like you're on this fast-moving treadmill where every founder is talking about, what do I need to do in the next 6 to 9 months? And it's always with the lens of to get to the next round. Whereas I'd much rather people have a very long-term vision of how do I just build the best, most enduring, long-term valuable business. And I really like shifting that mindset. So it is Turtle Ventures. It's not about being slow moving. It's about being long living. And that's what I'm looking for in marketplaces.
That makes a lot of sense. And so what was it about venture capital specifically that drew you into the space?
Well, initially, I wasn't sure if I was going to be long-term in venture capital or if I was going to go back into an operating role, but I sort of got to do a little bit of both. I actually started as a senior associate way back when, 10 years ago, and I was also dabbling as an advisor and helping Rev and things like that. But as I got into the role, I love it. It's one of the best jobs in the world. You get to talk to incredibly smart founders every single day that are trying to reshape their industries. And so very quickly realized that I was going to be doing this long term.
And why do you love marketplaces? And is that what the new fund is going to be focused on?
100%. So it's all marketplaces. That's the only thing I know really well.
I had a hunch.
Lucky guess. So there's a great Warren Buffett quote where he talks about Ted Williams and the science of bidding. And it's really simple, just knowing your strike zone. And Ted Williams, for anyone that doesn't know, he was the last baseball player that hit over 400, one of the Red Sox greats. I'm from New Hampshire and Boston, so that's in my DNA. But he knew if the ball came in this tiny little area of the strike zone, he was going to hit way over 400. If it went anywhere else, he was like 250, 300. And he just knew that. Anywhere else, he'd just try to foul it off or take the ball, whatever. And the beauty of investing is that you can take as many balls as you want. You could see 100 deals in a row that you pass on. And the thing that pays off is patience and knowing your strike zone. So at the end of the day, I know a lot about marketplaces. I've been doing it for 17 years now and seeing B2B, consumer, everything, and from property tech to fintech to rental cars and clothes. And I know that very well. And I also know that I don't know anything else very well. So I stick to marketplaces.
And talk to us about what appeals to you about marketplaces as a business and business model. And I know that there have been famous investors that have been attracted to marketplaces like Benchmark and others. And so talk to us about why you feel like that's your strike zone.
So first of all, I just find them fun and interesting. They are in many ways much more complex than your typical SaaS business where you build some software, figure out your go-to-market, and just try to scale. Marketplaces, you're obviously dealing with both buyers and sellers and building the platform. And there's just so many variations, right? You can have this buyer picks type marketplace like Airbnb or more like a seller picks Uber, where you don't pick the rider, it just shows up. And designing the right marketplace for the industry you're in is really hard. It's really complex and there's so many different options. So I love that almost engineering aspect of it. There's all these things you can play with around matching algorithms, feedback scores, you name it. And so I find them intellectually challenging and a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, they're also more financially successful in many ways. I believe it's Battery Ventures has a really nice public marketplace index where they look at 30 public marketplace companies versus the S&P versus the NASDAQ, and the marketplaces outperform. And I think the reason is quite simple. They have better defensibility than almost any other businesses. That's another reason it's called Turtle Ventures, by the way. They're highly defensible, right? They got this big armor plating all around them. And I've seen it. I was early at Odesk and got to see us grow from basically zero to when I left, we were doing a little over 100 million in GMV. And there were so many times where I thought we completely screwed up. It's like, okay, we launched this new feature. Everybody's pissed off at us, whatever. But the business had such high defensibility that it didn't matter. And you could recover from all that stuff. And I even saw in the early days, we were always panicking because every week there would be a new competitor that we saw. Some people ripped us off completely. Some people were launching freelance marketplaces of some other various sort. And we were always so scared and paranoid in the first year or so. And then another year or two went by and we realized they have no chance. There's no way that they're going to catch up. It is so hard to get these things going. And then once it does going, it's just so highly defensible, builds this big moat. That's the thing I love.
Right. What appeals to a lot of people, and me included, because I love marketplaces too, is that you build these network effects that naturally keep people into, even when they're upset, that's the thing that produces the most value to either a buyer or a seller. However, it's hard to get it to a point where it's stability, right? Isn't that part of the challenge? And is that something that as you've invested across different companies, you have some great advice or shortcuts on how to get there?
Yeah, the classic chicken and the egg problem.
Right.
So I call it liquidity hacking. I thought it was going to take off like growth hacking, but hasn't yet. So I think of it as liquidity hacking. And the important thing for people to understand is in a marketplace, liquidity is the product. And this is what people have never fully understood about Craigslist. Everybody's like, ah, Craigslist is terrible. Like, why is it even still around? Well, the answer is liquidity. You post something on Craigslist, you're going to get 20 responses right away. And that's what you're selling, that interaction. And I wrote a blog post a long time ago called Liquidity Hacking, which anyone can Google. But the summary is you have a few choices. There's the classic single player mode, right? Build some great tool that gets a whole bunch of people on board and then add the other side. In my experience, that actually usually doesn't work, but it's been done before. Another way is just ridiculous segmentation. And I've seen so many companies come, it's like, oh, we're going to revolutionize the industry. You can post anything and buy anything. And it's like, okay, well, that's not going to work. You'll never get liquidity because in the beginning, you just have a few buyers and sellers. So you need to make sure that whatever is posted, whether it's a job, a stroller, whatever, there's an equal number of buyers and sellers on the platform. And the only way to do that in early days without much resources is to segment ridiculously narrow. I led the Series A and Opera Up at Jackson Square Ventures way back in the day. It's the largest mobile classified site in the US. But when they started, all it was baby and kids stuff for new moms, ages 25 to 40, only in a few zip codes in Seattle.
Wow.
That was it. People don't realize that because today it's everything, right? Millions and millions of listings of absolutely everything. But they started with a ridiculously narrow focus. And that's what allowed them to scale.
Right. And they have now scaled into a large number of things. And a lot of it is very localized across the US now. So how do people think about that? How is it different than an eBay?
Well, the number one reason is it's local. It's much more of a Craigslist competitor than an eBay competitor.
Right.
But it's also much more consumer to consumer. eBay is really a B2C business. And I think if you look at the history of eBay, I think they missed their big opportunity. They pivoted to move more and more to try to compete with Amazon. And that's not a wise choice. I think they've lost some of that consumer to consumer brand that they had.
For founders who are obviously looking to start a marketplace business at this point in time, what other pieces of advice might you have for them?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I tend to focus on at Turtle Ventures. The first thing is picking the industry. People pick a lot of wrong industries. The example I always give is people try to do Uber for locksmiths. Well, I'm sure you can create a better experience there, but who cares? I've used a locksmith twice in my life and paid $100 or so. And it's just not an interesting cohort. So the things I like are people that go after massive existing markets that have weak and fragmented incumbents with massive amounts of inefficiency. Those to me are like the three starting criteria. And I think efficiency is the North Star in marketplaces. If you can't make it easier and faster and more efficient to discover buyers and sellers and complete transactions and make sure everything works well, you don't really have a reason to exist. So I think you need to find one of these industries where you see it and you're like, this sucks, we can make it better. And the question is how you do that. And by the way, there's plenty of industries where you look at it and you're like, well, actually pretty good. There's not a ton of opportunity to improve it. That's no good. And then a lot of time people go after markets that are just too small, or have only a handful of massive incumbents. And if that's the case, then you can never really get transaction fees because you'll just get beaten up by the bigger players. So those are the starting criteria to me. And if someone can come along and use mobile, use AI, use whatever you want to make things way, way better, especially in the discovery and the transaction process, then you have a huge opportunity. And then it becomes more of an exercise of, okay, well, what type of marketplace should I design? How should it look? Should it be like an Uber or like an Airbnb or a Thumbtack or an Upwork, whatever? Like, what's the model, if you will?
Right.
And then figure out your go-to-market and your liquidity hacking, and then go raise a bunch of money and keep scaling.
We're going to make liquidity hacking a thing.
Yes, we're going to promote it. We're going to hashtag this episode, liquidity hacking.
Exactly.
I love it.
What are the most important qualities or characteristics of a founder that you look for?
It's a good question. I'll start off by saying, first of all, everybody wants great founders. Everybody says, hey, we invest in people. And yeah, I say the same thing. But being intellectually honest, if you chart out 100 founders, I might be able to identify the top 10, maybe the top 10%. But I'm just not good enough to assess who's number one through 10. You have a handful of meetings, you get to know some people. I'm looking for people that I think are great. I'm often wrong, but I also look for people that really just have unique insights about their industry. They come in and just have this very clear picture of, hey, let me tell you about this industry. Maybe it's pharmacy. And let me tell you why it's so inefficient. And they can just very clearly articulate in a space that I know nothing about structurally why it's wrong, why it's broken, why it's inefficient, and have a clear vision of how they can fix it. And being able to articulate that story of why things are broken and how to fix it is, first of all, it's quite rare and it's very powerful when someone has it. So that's probably the number one focus. And I've actually had, I think, more success with first-time founders than repeat founders. I don't necessarily know why. I have. So if they have that clear articulation, if they're super smart, if they're scrappy, if they're humble in the sense they know what they know, they know what they don't know, then I'd love to work with them.
So is this StrikeZone, the marketplace's business, one where you're going to have hundreds of startups, or is this the kind of place where you're going to find like 20? Because I mean, there's obviously some huge businesses that have been created. I'm trying to get a sense for how widespread this business model is going to be.
Yeah, I'm obviously a huge believer in marketplaces. And I believe there's literally no end to the opportunities. I think a lot of people probably said the exact same thing about the SaaS industry 10, 20 years ago. Like, hey, haven't we built all the great big software companies? And well, those were horizontal platforms like CRM. And then people came along and made verticals and people made it better and better and better. And the world changes. You got to keep up. So if you just look at that criteria, massive existing markets with massive amounts of inefficiency, I'm amazed on a daily basis. Founders that come in and introduce me to new industries, the wholesale seafood industry, or I talked to one, the pharma contract research industry. I talked to a founder today. And every one of these, they come in and this is a $10 billion, $50 billion, $100 billion industry that most of us aren't thinking about. And they're everywhere. And largely they're quite inefficient. Another fun exercise I do sometimes is just go through the Bureau of Labor Statistics and look at where all these people are working and just think about their daily life and think about, can you improve it? Or look through the list of top 100 retailers in the country and you start looking down the list. You're like, wow, tires for cars is a ridiculously huge industry. It's not what we think about often in Silicon Valley, but the number one retailer there does something like $3.5 billion in revenue a year in tires. That's it. So I think there's almost an endless amount of opportunities here.
Are there enabling technologies that have made the marketplace business better? Obviously, mobile phones have radically changed it, right? But are there some other things that are enabling building a better marketplace better, fast, or creating opportunities for more of them?
I'd say we've gotten much better at marketplace design over the last 20 years. You look at the marketplaces 20 years ago, and it was Craigslist, right? It was just this completely horizontal thing. And now they're so much easier to use. The platforms are taking on more of the responsibility of matching and feedback and fraud prevention, all those things. But the biggest enablers really are the obvious ones. It's mobile. And the only one I would add is things like Facebook and Instagram give you really an incredible ability to target those narrow segments. And those are the biggest enabling functions.
And so would you consider yourself to be with this new fund, a pretty active hands-on investor? How are you planning to work with founders? And then if you want to highlight maybe one or two former companies or something like that, I think that'd be great too.
Yeah. So the new fund, the plan will be to do quite a bit more volume than what I used to do at Jackson Square Ventures. So I'll probably invest in about 40 to 50 early stage marketplaces in the first fund. So I won't be taking board seats, but I will have an active role in the sense that I know my strike zone. And I think I'm very good at helping founders really understand that marketplace design and the early liquidity hacking. And then once they get past that point, I'm happy to step back. So that's what I'll be doing with Turtle Ventures. I mentioned OfferUp. A couple of the other really interesting portfolio companies from the previous firm are Alto Pharmacy, which is same day delivery pharmacy, doing incredibly well, really a direct Walgreens CVS competitor and just an order of magnitude better experience for users. And there's another one called Crexy, which is a commercial real estate marketplace. You can think of it like a Zillow for commercial real estate, which is doing incredibly well. And then for the past year, I've been doing a lot of personal investments that will play a role in Turtle Ventures and have done things like Kite, which is a rental car company, much better experience. Curtsy, which is like a Poshmark, again, much better experience, more efficient. Model Living is a home remodeling startup. Did one called Thermal Travel, which is much better experience for people traveling based on specific interests, like surfing, take surfing trips. But of course, you can see how it would apply to lots of different interest-based travel. And about a dozen more, you can see them all on the website.
So we've spoken to a few solo GPs. And as far as I can tell, you're going to be a solo GP, right, for now?
Correct.
What is that experience like? I mean, you haven't closed the fund yet, but you're in the process. Any insights from that? How is it different than your life before?
I absolutely love it. I love the freedom and flexibility that comes with being a solo capitalist. The obvious thing you miss is having thought partners around that you can talk about deals with, that challenge your thinking, that help you make better decisions. And so that's something I think all solo capitalists need to figure out a way to supplement. And for me, I fortunately have worked with a ton of great marketplace founders. So I have my informal council that I go to and can just chat about ideas and chat about new startups and get their perspective. And so I'll be formalizing that over time as I move forward. But I think that's really important to just find a way to have great thought partners.
How has COVID or the COVID era impacted how you're looking at marketplaces or in what particular kind of category you're specifically interested in?
Yeah, COVID's thrown everybody for a loop and made us all realize how bad we are at forecasting things. I remember in the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, every single VC predicted a horrible 2-year recession, and then the stock market boomed for the next 15 months. So we're really bad at this forecasting thing, but there's no question it's changed work. It's changing how everyone is expecting we're going to work in the future. There's going to be way more hybrid remote work flexibility. I think the migration is very real from cities to more suburban or rural areas. And I personally believe that trend will continue. So I have made some investments that tie into those tailwinds. One is a company called Outsite, which it's a sort of co-living, co-working facilities all around the world for members that want to live this sort of digital nomad lifestyle, which I think is really exciting. So there's going to be things like that. And you just have to use a little bit of a COVID lens when you're looking at any company to understand, hey, do you have tailwinds behind you or do you have headwinds? And this is going to be an uphill battle.
One thing I want to ask for is obviously in every marketplace, you need a rating system, right? To create trustworthiness between two different parties. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about all the ratings on Amazon and how the manipulation of that and all that kind of stuff. So how do you think about that? And how do you prevent abuse of that system?
I've seen it firsthand. So I designed the initial feedback system at Odesk way back in the day. I know many of the flaws with these systems. I hate five-star feedback systems. They're fundamentally flawed. And the reason they're flawed is you go take an Uber ride and give someone 4 stars and they'll immediately ping you like, oh my God, what went wrong? Okay, you're just sort of asking for 5 stars, aren't you? And if you look at the distribution, if you look at how many 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, in any one of these marketplaces, there's going to be a few 1s. There'll be some 1s for people that had a really bad experience, almost 0 2s, almost 0 3s, a few 4s, and then the vast majority 5s. And so all those systems can really do is point out the bad experiences. They find the bad actors. They find some of the people or products that are just terrible. They don't really do anything to reflect real life. And I believe real life experiences are much more like a normal curve. Most things are relatively in the middle. They're okay. They weren't amazing. They weren't terrible. They were somewhere in the middle. And then there were a few ones that were absolutely incredible and amazing. And five-star feedback systems cannot identify those.
So how do you solve for that?
Well, probably the single best feedback system in the world is Google. They search trillions of web pages. I don't know, maybe we're up to quadrillions now. And they usually surface the top few pages on pretty much anything you're looking at. But you'll notice they never ask, hey, can you rank this website? They never ask because they use all behavioral data, authoritative data. There's something like 300 different factors that they use to try to identify the top things. Whereas marketplaces, we pretty much just use 1. And so we're in the super early innings of getting good marketplace ranking systems. And we need more user authority. We need to rely much more on behavioral data of, hey, I saw these two products. I bought this one. And then guess what? I returned it. So that should be a huge signal. Or I bought it again, which would be a huge positive signal. So you have to look for signals in other places that's based more on user behavior and less on user feedback. Because as we've all seen, user feedback can and will be gamed very aggressively because there's just too much value ascribed to it. People know that you get a bunch of positive reviews, well, your sales are going to go up. And we need platforms to stop that.
Yeah. And psychologically, people are more inclined to rate a bad review if they had a bad experience than a positive review.
So fun fact, one of the interesting signals that people can use is just the response rate. So imagine two items that both got, whatever, 4.5 stars. Well, if one of them had a 20% response rate and one of them had an 80% response rate, that's a massively different product. That's a massively different signal.
I felt totally manipulated recently when I had bought this product, which clearly came from some very smart marketing group out of China. I bought the product and then when you open it, it says, hey, you can get some warranty and another copy of the product for free. Come and do a review or even give us an email, right? Like give us your email. And I'm like, wait, they're just going to track the hell out of me. That's what they want, right? Or log in with your Facebook credentials. Yeah. It was actually surprising because that made me think the value of me is higher than the cost of the product to them, which was incredible.
That's right. That's right. So this is exactly the problem. There's way too much value in those reviews. That's not what we should be relying on. By the way, the flip side is true as well. If you want to get free products, just give somebody a 1-star rating and they'll say, oh, sorry, we'll refund all your money. And then if you change it to 5 stars, which is absurd. And so you have pretty unscrupulous people doing that sort of feedback blackmail, which is terrible. And we can fix all this stuff, but it takes a lot of energy, a lot of focus. It's also just this war, right? The platforms will change something and then all the smart entrepreneurs that are selling on it will try to game the new system. And then you need to keep iterating and keep making it better and better.
Maybe we need a platform company that makes a better rating system that is licensed across marketplaces.
Yeah, well, there's people working on that too.
Cool.
And what do you think about the current environment with valuations?
Oh, well, generally, I think it's pretty crazy, but people always think it's crazy when you're on the buy side. Founders don't think it's crazy. So
yeah,
these things sort themselves out in the long run. I'm not too concerned about it. I try to find the best marketplaces, the best founders I can, and I don't worry quite as much about valuation.
Yeah, that makes sense. So now we're going to switch to our 4 standard question segment, and we're looking forward to hearing your answers. Question one is our MVCA question. The National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem, which is a mouthful. If there was one thing that you would change about the venture capital industry or one policy that you'd advocate for, what would it be?
I would advocate for much easier, much more aggressive, and much more incentivized immigration for founders. And it always breaks my heart when I talk to incredibly smart, talented people that are put through absolute hell to try to immigrate to the US. And we should have our doors wide open with welcoming arms to smart people that want to come here and create companies. And I think the US needs to pay attention and not take things for granted. You look around the world and you see what countries like Estonia are doing. They're inviting entrepreneurs. And unless the US changes things, we will lose in the long run.
Can I just ask you about this one? Because that's a big issue for me too. And I think we need to be pro-immigration. But when I've discussed this issue with people and I say we need to target our immigration to the areas that benefit the US, people find that insulting. And they say, no, anybody who has tough life anywhere in the world should be able to come. And I am of the view that we need to be proactive in the areas where people can benefit the US. And that's how the US has become such a great place. Is that controversial?
I don't find it controversial. I could also easily imagine there's multiple paths for immigration, right? It's not like the only immigrants we'll accept are tech founders. Nobody's saying that.
Nobody's saying that. Exactly.
No one in the world would say that. And so I personally think these things are compatible.
But it's crazy not to try to attract smart tech founders here from overseas.
Agreed.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. I mean.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. It's just, should we attract tech founders? Yes. It's the end of the discussion.
Exactly. Number two, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I love being a VC. I actually can't think of a better job, but I will say one of my things I'd like to do much more of going forward is actually financial education for children. I have two young kids of my own now, 5 and 6, and I love them, but they want to spend all their money on candy and toys.
As one does.
Yeah, as they do. But I got them to start investing and buying tiny pieces of stocks, and they're starting to understand what it is. But I think when you look at our education system and you look at the curriculums, we never touch finance at all. And we teach all our kids things they'll never use, like calculus and trig and stuff like that. But we don't teach any basics of financial education. And I think that's really sad. I think the world and society could be a much happier place if we all had a little bit more there.
We have to put a plug here for one of our companies,
yeah.
Greenlight. If you don't know, it's a debit card that is designed to teach kids about saving and spending and investing, et cetera. So
fantastic.
So number three, who is someone that you look up to and why?
So the one that's closest to my industry, I'd have to give the nod to Bill Gurley at Benchmark or former Benchmark, mostly just because he's basically the GOAT of marketplace investing. And he's obviously had a ridiculously impressive career and track record, but he's also done it in a way that when he speaks, people listen, and he's able to convince probably millions of people every time he talks about the way the world should work or how policies should change or whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's a good one. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received is the fourth question.
Actually, I have two because I couldn't pick one. But I would say early in my career, the best advice was really simple. It was act as if. And at the time, I was junior or mid-level, and the company would be going through all these challenges. And I think the normal course of action is like, well, okay, that's not my department, or that's not my problem, or whatever. And if you take a different approach where you act as if you're the owner or the CEO of the company, and what would you do to fix it? It changes your mindset, and it changes what you do and perform. And one of the reasons I had 7 different roles or something at Odesk in the early days is I kept raising my hand. Every time I saw some new challenge, I was like, we have a problem in marketing. I want to go fix it. And that was incredibly powerful. So act as if you're sort of at the next level or at the next tier. And then the other one, which I think is just a really powerful quote, is from Steve Jobs, which obviously I didn't receive directly, but he talked about once you realize the world was created by people that are just like you with all the same foibles and everything else, you realize that you can also change absolutely anything in the world. And that's a really powerful mindset for both VCs and founders. So it's one that I always try to keep in mind is nothing is going to be the same way forever. And you can always improve on it.
That's great advice.
Awesome. Josh, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate spending time with you and learning more about your background and Turtle Ventures.
Thank you both.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc.